Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Over the last several months, we've aired a series of interviews with historian Matthew Dennis on major American public holidays. He'll be joining us again this week to discuss the origins and evolution of Columbus Day. Dennis is the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. And following that, we'll continue our series of readings from the recollections of field hospital service during the War of Secession, the unpublished reminiscences of T.B. Brown. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news, this week on our subject, Christopher Columbus. As an update on what we've reported over the past few years, Galvin Menzies continues his search for evidence to support his theory that the Chinese preceded Columbus to America. According to a recent news account in the Singapore Straits Times, Menzies is now seeking answers from DNA samples. In his book, 1421, The Year China Discovered America, published in 2001, Menzies maintained that some sailors and concubines who accompanied the Ming Dynasty Admiral Cheng Ho on his voyages to the New World settled in the Americas, founded settlements there, and had intimate relations with the Native Americans. Menzies suggested that preliminary tests on the DNA of some of the indigenous people of North and South America, he identified the Maya in particular, support his claim, but that further testing was necessary. As in the past, historians skeptical of Menzies' claims say they will await further evidence. And also related to DNA tests, researchers studying DNA from 500-year-old bone slivers have reported that preliminary data suggests that Christopher Columbus might be buried in Spain rather than in the Dominican Republic. In a news report out of Madrid, the team of researchers stressed that it had reached no conclusion and that much more research was needed. But it said that DNA samples taken from bones that Spain said were the explorers matched DNA from a body widely thought to be that of his brother, Diego. Both have been unearthed in Seville as part of a study to settle a 100-year-old dispute over where Columbus's bones now rest after a series of reinterments on both sides of the Atlantic. When we return, I will speak with Matthew Dennis about the history of Columbus Day. This is Talking History. We mark the annual celebration of Columbus Day with another in our year-long series of interviews with Matthew Dennis, the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar. Matthew is also a professor of history at the University of Oregon. Welcome, Matthew.
Nice to be with you, Brian.
Let's start off with a question that's probably on a lot of people's mind. Columbus Day has really become one of the most controversial of American civic holidays, a situation that began really during the quincentenary commemoration of 1992 and still goes on to a certain extent, although nowhere with quite the volume that it did back then. And you write in your book of the event of 1992 that it did not alter social, economic, or political life, nor did it recreate the past. Yet the various events shaped public memory and subjected America's past to popular interpretation. Now, that really brings two things together, our knowledge of the past and our memory of the past. Can you kind of talk about those in terms of what happened in 1992?
Well, in 1992, as it approached, there were all sorts of efforts to commemorate the 500th anniversary of Columbus's voyage of discovery. What was interesting in many ways is that those who were organizing these events often didn't anticipate that they would be in any way controversial. Columbus had been around as an American hero for a long time and in some ways had just kind of lost, you know, any kind of particular stature or a sense of what he really meant. And so these events proceeded into a kind of a squall that exploded when the promoters confronted a changed American society, one that was much more self-consciously multicultural, and began to ask different questions about the past and about our heroes. And Columbus, while representing a kind of ethnic hero, especially to Italian Americans for a long time, or as just being, you know, one of those figures that you study in second grade history and then forget about, all of a sudden he became the representative of genocide to some, the one who initiated 500 years of colonialism, exploitation, environmental degradation, and the list would go on and on. And so all of a sudden, we see this kind of explosion that caught a lot of people by surprise.
It did catch a lot of people. I remember that well enough because I was working on the topic myself, and I remember that people were building up to this, what they considered to be a huge event, years before it came. And, of course, the explosion that you just pointed to started at least a couple years before 1992, and it really caught people by surprise. I think people expected the Native Americans to be upset, and we can talk about that in a moment, but groups that you wouldn't consider to be left-wing or radical fringe, like the National Council of Churches and groups like that, talking about having a day of mourning, and I think it did surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Columbus Day and the 500th anniversary in particular was seen by many as a teaching moment. I think the promoters of it saw it as a promotional moment, and those two things didn't really jibe.
Right, good point. Okay, we'll come back to that, but let's get the historical point of view out of here to start with. For better or for worse, what can we credit Columbus with from an historian's perspective?
Well, Columbus is one of the most famous and important historical figures that we have. He was likely not the first person to find the so-called New World. He had been anticipated by Leif Erikson by about 500 years. But what's significant is that he did make this journey with his small crew in 1492, and he joined two old worlds that had been separated for a long time. After Columbus's voyage, the Americas would not be separated from Europe and the rest of the world ever again. And so while in many ways his discovery was a mistake, he thought he was heading for Asia, and lucky for him, the globe was much smaller than he realized, and thus when he ran aground on the American continents, it saved his life. He probably would have, you know, never made it to Asia. But after he did this, he brought consciousness of the Americas to Europe and initiated a long-term process of the movement of people, animals, plants, and pathogens. So the world was transformed after his voyage.
Right. Crosby did some work on what he called the Columbian Exchange and had to do with all the things that you just mentioned. It's always intriguing for people to think about how someone who was an Italian or Genoan who sailed for Spain nevertheless ends up being a hero for the United States, and he never set foot on U.S. territory. How and when did we first celebrate Columbus's landing in the United States?
You know, it is a kind of a weird story. There were some in America who celebrated Columbus in the 17th century, but really it began in the late 18th century. And following the American Revolution, Americans were trying to figure out who they were. Their identity was being shaped. They were shaping a sense of who they are, what their destiny might be, how they were distinctive, or how they were related to Europe. Columbus is, in some ways, an empty vessel. Obviously an important figure historically, but one about whom we know very little. And so Columbus could become an American hero in some ways because he had few liabilities, and the liabilities that he had were easily overlooked. The most important thing Columbus had going for him is that he was not British. So he was an American hero that could bypass a British colonial past as Americans were trying to figure out who they were. So Columbus is someone that could be erected as an American hero, someone who could symbolize for Americans a spirit of innovation, of expansion, of economic development, almost whatever Americans wanted to imagine about themselves. And so he was a kind of founding father who was conveniently not English.
And yet we associate with his name, not just the name Columbus, but we even make other forms of his name, such as the term Columbia and the Columbiad and other kinds of variations on that. Probably most easily recognizable to our listeners would be our nation's capital, which is Washington in the District of Columbia. How did that association come to be?
If Columbus was kind of a vague figure, then he could be even further personified as Columbia. And so in a way then, the American landscape could be domesticated by renaming it, by claiming it, associating it with Columbus. So we see the emergence of the District of Columbia, the new capital of South Carolina, Columbia, new cities emerging in the old Northwest, Columbus, Ohio, or the renaming of the great river of the Pacific Northwest, the Columbia. King's College in New York City couldn't remain King's College after the Revolution. It was transformed into Columbia. So it was a way of claiming and domesticating the American landscape, transforming it into something in the image of Columbus, which increasingly then stood for a kind of new American empire. If Columbus was sailing originally for Spain, for Ferdinand and Isabella, an expanding Spanish empire, Columbus now somehow, in this personified way, could represent an American empire of a different sort, an empire of liberty.
A founding father, if you will, tied to our other founding father, George Washington.
Okay. Right. And we have, besides Washington, Columbus lent his name to more places in America than any other person, at least until the advent of Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, as I said earlier, the association of Columbus with certain very clear liabilities in his own actual history, something like initiating the transatlantic slave trade, fell aside. And so some of the new societies that were trumpeting Columbus saw him actually as an anti-slavery figure, someone who represented liberty. They weren't thinking so much of slavery. They were thinking of the liberation from Europe, which he somehow represented, even though he was sailing for Spain.
Interesting point. One of the individuals that helped transform this popular image of Columbus was Washington Irving. Many of our listeners probably don't recall that Irving wrote biographies as well as fiction. He wrote one of George Washington, for example. But what did he write about Columbus, and how did he help this transformation of Columbus's image?
Well, Irving was a writer of great energy, and in 1828 he published a biography of Columbus. He was interested in literature, and it was historical, but there was a lot of imagination in his history as well. He's really the one who kind of sculpted a mythic image of Columbus that would then translate itself into school textbooks and into a kind of popular sense of who Columbus was, and it was long enduring. He wasn't so much interested in the kind of precise, verifiable, constantly revised history that historians would write, and often he was actually fairly disdainful towards historians who would, you know, let the facts get in the way of a great story, talking about a great man that somehow symbolized America and could teach Americans lessons.
Let's pick up on that a bit, because what we see is, from looking at your book here, the image of Columbus continues to build throughout the 19th century, maybe reaches its highest point in 1893 in the Columbian Exposition. But even at that point, and certainly in the next couple of decades to follow, historians are at least attempting to get the facts in the way. And tell us a little bit about how the professional historians began to part company, if you will, with popular historians.
Well, that's a long and complicated story, certainly. We could even look back to the 1790s when a French philosophe, the Abbé Raynal, sponsored an essay contest to ask if Columbus's discoveries were actually a good thing or bad thing. A prize was never awarded because there was no consensus on the best answer, but many of them said no because of what happened in the aftermath of Columbus. By the last decade of the 19th century in the United States, a historian, Justin Windsor, came out with a book that expressed a great disappointment in Columbus. There's so much that he could accomplish and yet didn't. It was as critical as any critical revisionist works we'd see today. But there was always a kind of disjuncture between the historical analysis of Columbus, the real historical figure, and Columbus in American memory and in myth. And so works like Windsor became almost irrelevant as the memory and myth of Columbus continued to grow. Columbus was a really useful figure, not only at the beginning of American history to help represent what American was or was supposed to be or aspired to be, but quickly, at least by the middle of the 19th century, he became an ethnic hero. Because he wasn't British, in fact, because he was Catholic, he could be an ethnic Catholic, originally Irish, but then Italian, or Hispanic, founding father, the original immigrant. And so he could somehow represent all of that, not colonialism, but American pluralism. And then by the late 19th century, when Americans celebrated the 400th anniversary of his voyage, he became all things to all people, it seems. The excuse for a huge exposition in Chicago, a week of celebrations in New York, and a lot of this was just basically boosterism. It was more about American business and the expansion of America throughout the world than it was about Columbus, the real living, breathing person who lived at that point 400 years earlier. So there's this ongoing disjuncture that occasionally causes problems when we either revise who we think Columbus is or should have been, or actually do let the facts get in the way and disturb our blissful memories.
Okay, let me take you into the 20th century, and let me do it by mentioning the title of one of the last sections of your chapter on Columbus, Goodbye Columbus? The Contest to Define Columbus and the Nation in Modern America. What was that about?
As I said earlier, one of the things that was problematic about Columbus in the 20th century, outside of certain ethnic circles, was that he had become basically boring. no one really cared about Columbus. And yet there's this latent potency for Columbus to emerge and be important again. We see this in 1992, when Columbus as an anti-hero can provide a symbol for the problems in American society and historically. And there can be a way to heighten sensitivity towards the experience of Native people in the continent, the course of environmental degradation that's occurred over hundreds of years. So it was kind of a wake-up call, and Columbus, in a way, was very useful to make that point because so much attention was focused on the 500th anniversary. Columbus will continue to be important as well, I think, as an ethnic hero, as someone who could suggest that it was okay and legitimate to be a hyphenated American, that there are other ways of being American than being a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, for example. And, you know, Columbus, in his symbolic glory representing going beyond the next frontier, is kind of an important trope in American life and culture. Americans look to the future. They want to imagine that things can be better, that they don't have to conserve, they don't have to change their behavior, they can find something new so that that old pie doesn't have to be sliced any thinner. A new pie exists somewhere beyond. And so for all those reasons, and probably a lot of others, and because his biography is so thin, it's likely that he'll become and remain important in the future.
Okay, well, we're out of time, and that's a great place to leave it. So let me thank you again, Matt, for joining us. And as always, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to you joining us again in November to discuss Thanksgiving.
Great to talk with you, Brian.
I've been speaking with Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, An American Calendar, published by Cornell University Press. And this is Talking History. We now continue with our reading of excerpts from T.V. Brown's recollections of field hospital service during the War of Secession. As you may recall, Brown, a German immigrant, wrote his recollections some 30 years after the Civil War, during which he served in the Union Army as hospital steward with the rank of sergeant. In our fourth excerpt, Brown recounts the aftermath of the Battle of Malvern Hill, June 30, 1862. Last week's segment included an account of the escapades of Corporal Mumford before the Civil War. Brown had been chatting with Mumford, unaware of the impending Confederate attack. Now, as the gunfire subsides, Mumford lies dead. Our reader, David Jones, picks up the story.
Poor Mumford! In less than a half hour after he had said to me, "One of these days we'll know," he had not only been killed, but buried, for a grave was dug on the spot for the three victims of misplaced confidence. Hardly had the echo of our last gun ceased reverberating, when an artilleryman rode up to Dr. Sternberg. "Lieutenant Blank sends his compliments, and says that his best man has had his arm torn off by the premature discharge of his gun, and he wishes you to do what you can for him immediately," said the man. "Tell Lieutenant Blank to send him here," answered the doctor. "Have a stretcher set up on the level ground overhead," Dr. Sternberg said to me, "and get the field case, chloroform, water, sponges, etc., ready, and we will operate." I did as directed, and when the wounded man arrived, proceeded at once to anesthetize him. Just as the doctor began to operate, a signal party came galloping up, and jumped off their horses and began to signal, and, as usual, the enemy straightway shelled them in rigorous fashion, and the shells went shrieking over us and exploded in most unpleasant proximity. Dr. Sternberg went on with the operation and finished it, but was too nervous to tie the vessels. He accordingly did up the stump as though the arteries had been tied, and directed me to select four of the best men of the regimental band, put the most intelligent one in charge, and order them to carry the man to the field hospital, 2 miles away in the direction of the James River, and to be sure to find the surgeon in charge there, explain to him that it was impossible under the circumstances for Dr. Sternberg to tie the blood vessels, and to request him to have it attended to at once. This was done. The message was delivered to the surgeon in charge of the hospital, but in the turmoil and excitement of the day, it was evidently overlooked. Our wounded fell into the hands of the enemy on the following day, and we heard afterward that the poor fellow died from hemorrhage on the third day after the operation. While lying on our arms in the shade of the trees, ready to move whithersoever we might be called, considerable amusement was caused us by the sight of General Sykes, the division commander, walking leisurely up and down a small circular clearing accompanied by his provost marshal. Now and then a shell came along. You can never tell whether it is coming straight for you or passing hundreds of yards to your right or left till it has passed you. General Sykes never noticed them, continued his promenade with his usual sang-froid. Not so the provost marshal. At the sound of each approaching shell, he made a frantic rush for somewhere, anywhere, in such utter demoralization as would have disgraced a private in the rear rank. General Sykes would watch his headlong flights with an amused grin, and from a smile at the beginning, a general guffaw went the round of the division at the oft-renewed gyrations of the provost marshal, who was evidently born with an unconquerable aversion from shells in that form, and, as a kindred feeling makes us wondrous kind, I sympathized not a little with the poor man's erratic legs, for doubtless his soul was ashamed of them. During the afternoon, as our party was moving along behind the regiment in close order, a solid shot struck the ground in the center of the party. Under such circumstances, men instinctively seek the embrace of Mother Earth, which I accordingly did with promptness and dispatch. As I did so, I caught a last glimpse of the entire party clinging to terra firma. Even the doctor's horse, which was being led by one of the hospital attendants, had thrown himself. I thought all had been killed, and congratulated myself of my escape, when presently the cloud of dust blew away, and we were rejoiced to discover that nobody had been hurt. During the second day, our gunboats on the James River took part in the fray by sending big shells at regular intervals in the direction of the enemy. Their fire was, of course, guided entirely by signals from our position. These shells made a fearful noise as they crashed through the woods for a mile or so before exploding, and when they did explode, they threw the noise of our field guns completely in the shade. No one who heard those gunboat shells is likely to forget, and I pitied the provost marshal whenever one of those gigantic missiles passed by.
You've been listening to David Jones, a student in the Graduate Theater Program at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, reading from T.V. Brown's Recollections of Field Hospital Service During the War of Secession. Our thanks to the Clendenning Library of the University of Kansas Medical Center for allowing us to use the unpublished manuscript. If you missed any of the previous segments in this series, you can find it at oah.org. Just click on Talking History and the programs that aired the weeks of September 19th through October 3rd. This is Talking History. And that's it for another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. We remind you that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that for more information on Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.